Good evening. What a beautiful sight to see all of you. Arousing practice in the midst of delusion. You attain realization before you realize it. Those are words from our great founder, Dogen Zenji. And I've been practicing with those words for at least 20 years. Since I first read them, overlooking a desert wash down at Joshua Tree, whenever that was, when you were climbing some wall with Anne. Anyhow, it really touched me because I think it's kind of the beautiful, hopeful aspect of our practice, which is that as deluded as we all are, in any moment, we can arouse practice right in the midst of our delusion, and that is our realization. So I want to talk about delusion. And offer you a couple of definitions and some different responses. I don't think there's any one way to arouse practice, but I've at least named four that I would like to share with you. And just a few preface comments. I'm going to be referring to a couple of teachers in particular that I've been studying their material over the years in regards to this question of delusion, of course, Dogen. So I think most of you know who he was, but if you're newer and you don't, he was one the founder of our Soto Zen school. He lived in the 1300s, 1200s, the 13th century. Right, which are the 1200s in Japan. And the other teacher is a contemporary teacher, Reb Anderson, particularly a class that I attended where he taught about the Lotus Sutra in Carmel and also his 2006 practice period class about karma, both times of which he talked a lot about delusion. So when I refer to Reb's, that's what I'm referring to. So a couple of definitions, because, you know, it's a word that we use in English, and it maybe has different meanings to different ones of us, but there are some kind of specific meanings that we talk about in the Buddhist tradition about what we mean by delusion. And one of them is that it's the story-making function that we have in our minds. Because we're human, we make up stories in our minds, and we think we call that reality. You know, so if I was just to stop talking right now and you started to listen to your interior monologue, that one, that little voice that has this commentary, I think you called it the radio host recently, the radio host that lives in our heads and describes reality and tells us what things mean and how we should interpret the actions of others and the happenings of our lives, the stories and the dots that we connect, that, oh, this means this and that means that, and therefore. So I want to right away, I'm going to confess a lot of my own delusion tonight. It's a very good practice. I encourage everybody to study your delusion. So I did get permission from Patrick to tell this story. it involves us, and it happened just recently during Sesshin. I was the cook. I was the Tenzo. And one of my frequent delusionary stories that I like to tell myself inside my head is, I know best. And if things aren't going the way that I think they should be going, it's because it's somebody's fault. Because I know best how things should be going. So there I was. Another little detail is that in the evening in Sesshin, there's something called gruel. And the gruel is like the leftovers. So the Tenzo makes gruel with the leftovers. So I showed up in the middle of Sesshin. There was another person who had been Tenzo before me. And I showed up halfway into Sesshin. And there were no leftovers to make the gruel. So immediately I got pretty huffy inside my head. My little radio host was going, huh! There's no leftovers. Oh, so that means I have to cook all this rice and pasta and make this bulk for people so that there's going to be something to put in the bowl at dinner time. Whose fault is it? Right? Because it's got to be somebody's fault. So, oh, it must be the prior Tenzo's fault. She's not from here. Maybe they do it differently where she's from. Oh, it must be Kokyo's fault because he always like lets people join Sashin after the sign up has started and wreaks havoc with the count. Must be Kokyo's fault. Anyhow, I went through that for a while. And then at some point I realized, oh, you know, actually the job of the Tenzo is to make it work with what you have. Dogen says, if you have cream, you cook with cream. If you have grass, you cook with grass. So I went, okay, all right, and then I had a pretty good time. Okay, so fast forward, end of Sashin, Patrick and I are talking in the room as we're changing and he was checking in with me about how things went, and at some point I grumbled about, and then would you believe it, there were no leftovers, and so that was why I wasn't in the Zendo for a while, because I had to be cooking all these pastas and stuff for the leftovers. And he said, oh, I did that. He said, there were some people there, and I gave them the leftovers. I said, please take these leftovers with you. And he said, I'm so sorry. And, oh, it was Patrick's fault. Ha! And, of course, with his confession and repentance and my just laughing at my delusion once again, oh, good, now am I happy that I know whose fault it was? You know, who cares, you know, and especially when I really thought about it, what had motivated him was generosity and spontaneity, right? So that's a little bit of my delusion. Another way to think about this that Dogen talks about is to carry yourself forward and illuminate the myriad things is delusion. That myriad things come forth and illuminate themselves is awakening. So to carry myself forward onto the world means putting my story out and imposing it on you as if my story was the right story. It's just a story, but I think it's the right story. So I carry myself forward onto the world and try to illuminate the world with my wisdom, you know, and my knowledge and my rightness. Whereas, and this is a huge ongoing learning for me, can I actually make space to allow the world to come to me and realize itself? That, Dogen says, is awakening. So... that's one definition, this constructed self that we carry forward. Now here's another one. This is a quote from Reb, and this one is also to me very, very powerful. As he says, and he said this to me in Dokusan, actually. He said, I said, what is delusion? And he said, when we don't think we're part of our causal network. When we don't think we're part of our causal network. We think we're separate from what's happening. Why does this keep happening to me? I've had some insight into this tendency that, of course, that we all have to think that, well, I don't have anything to do with what's happening. It's those other people. It's not me. In my work, I've done a fair amount of what's called organizational diagnosis, where an organization presents a problem and they want me to help them solve it. And before I work with them, I talk with each individual person one-on-one, confidentially, like, so what do you think, what's going on? What's the problem? What do you think needs to happen? You know, and pretty much everybody has some story about what's wrong and why it's happening and whose fault it is and what needs to happen to fix it. And what's so interesting about being the person in the role who's talking to everybody is after you hear like the 10th or the 11th or the 12th story, it's this amazing feeling of, oh, you know, every single person is right. Every single person's story for them is absolutely correct. But they're all different. So in a way, they're all right and nobody's right. Because ultimately, if what they want to do is try to resolve some bigger problem than any one individual person's story, there's some way that everybody needs to release their story a little bit. But of course, that takes some time. We have stories about this in Buddhism. The blind man and the elephant is a classic story. And maybe you've heard it. I don't know if you know that it's actually a Buddhist story. It's really out in the world as a teaching story, but it was actually Buddha who sent, you know, the blind men to go and find an elephant and said, tell me, you know, describe the elephant. And so, of course, the one who's touching the trunk says, oh, an elephant is a hose. And the one who's touching the leg, oh, the elephant is a tree. The one who's touching the hide, oh, the elephant is a leathery pillow. Maybe the one who touches the tusk, oh, an elephant is a knife. Of course, you know, we can see that it's true that those things, the parts of the elephant, those are, that's true. But is that what an elephant is? So those are a couple of definitions. And there's probably more. I know there's more, but those are the ones that I want to work with. So what the heck are we supposed to do about this? Because this is endless. It's inexhaustible. We all do it. Well, what's one of the things we can do? Study it. Study our delusion. Dogen says, those who are greatly enlightened about delusion are Buddhas. So if you think you're just some poor schmuck who has to study delusion because you're so deluded, actually, studying your delusion is the act of Buddha. Seeking to become enlightened and awakened about your delusion is a Buddha activity. So what does that look like? Well, study your tendencies. This is a Reb quote. He said, habit energy is just that which hasn't been looked at carefully enough. Habits are strong in relation to how little I've studied them. And then he went on to say, someone may ask you sometime, why are you so patient? And you say, I'm patient because I have studied my impatience for so long. Catherine told me years ago when I was saying, what should I study? What should I study? She said something that at the time I heard it, I didn't know what she was asking me to do. But she said, study your divided mind. Become intimate with the aggression of your own ego. My ego is aggressive? I don't know. Check it out. So I did and have. And this is something that I found that I wrote, I don't know, 2006, something like that. What stuns me every time I catch myself objectifying somebody else is how convincing my inner voice sounds, how it presents itself as the truth about that person. I rub my evidence into my defensive shield, making it harder and thicker until it feels downright impossible to feel anything kind or understanding about this other. But if I can allow my shield to soften, the opposite is true. I start feeling understanding, curiosity, maybe even affection or love. The fact that the hinge which opens the gate between love and hate is located in my own brain is liberating and terrifying at the same time. It's liberating because it gives me a place to work. If what I want to do is shift closer to love, I can always take the inward step to investigate my own part in the matter. I can always make room for the other to come forth, to speak and listen to one another, until some stone or stick of insight gets moved and breaks the log jam, allows the situation to evolve. But it is terrifying because of how often I don't take the inward step. How often I cling doggedly to my position. I could easily amass enough judgment to talk myself out of what I most deeply love, my marriage, my family, my sangha. So to me, that's kind of the urgent aspect to this practice, and why I think it really is very close to our suffering, because this place that I know I can get to if I'm just caught in my own delusion is very lonely. It's very, very lonely. So Dogen says, arousing practice in the midst of delusion, we attain realization before we realize it. So arousing practice, what's that? Well, I think one of the things it is confessing and repenting. Confessing our delusion. I confess my delusion to you. Let me tell you about my stories. Let me tell you about the stories that I tell about you. And then you can tell me the stories that you tell about me. Wow, isn't that amazing that we do that? Isn't that an incredible story that I made up about you? Wow, incredible. Patrick, oh, it was me. I'm the one who did that. He confessed. And repented, and it completely melted away the root of our transgression. There was no transgression. We're all making mistakes all the time, you know? How many mistakes have I made? How many times have I had to confess and repent to many of you in this room? So there's nothing wrong with it. There's no shame in it. There's so much shame in our culture about mistakes. We think, oh my God, I'm not supposed to make a mistake, and I'm going to end the world. You know, people run into that here when they do the jobs, right? Oh no, I'm not going to offer the incense the right way, and the doshi's going to get mad, or I don't know what we think is going to happen. So, you know, confessing and repenting is actually the exact transmission of a verified Buddha, Dogen says. That's the action of verified Buddhas, confessing and repenting our lack of faith and practice to one another. So that's one way, I think, of arousing practice in the midst of delusion. There's a lot of other ways we can do that. We might want to talk about it together in a bit. But then we also have a real challenge that's offered to us by our bodhisattva vow. Okay, I've talked about studying delusion. I've talked about arousing practice in the midst of delusion. But our bodhisattva vow, which is, delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. End them? Whoa, that sounds pretty hard. That sounds harder than studying them and arousing practice in the midst of them, to me. So what's that? I'm sorry Rob is not here because I wanted to just say something that he said a couple Sundays ago. We were talking about delusion in our Sunday night group, and he said, oh, ending delusion, that's easy. Just sit down on your zafu and do shikantaza. just think non-thinking. End of story. That's it. End it. Just stop it. Just stop doing it. Stop perseverating. Just stop it. End it. Okay. Oh, I think maybe that's a lifetime practice for some of us. Maybe for some it's easier. And there's many, many, many wonderful teachings that can encourage us how to do that. Uchiyama Roshi talks about it as opening the hand of thought. Maybe that's a good metaphor to use if you're struggling with that perseverating mind. If you can just tell yourself, almost like a mantra, just open that hand that is, open the fist. This is from Musang. Instead of clenching our fist around ideas of self and the world, open that hand. So am I clenching my fist around my idea of self and the world? Open, as Nanette was teaching us today in the Zendo. Breath, body. But then another approach is aversion therapy. That's kind of the one I tend to need. And aversion therapy is where you do something so much that you just get sick of it and you have to stop. So in Sesshin, when one sits for hours and hours and hours and days and days and days, not everybody, but people like me who struggle with perseverating mind, often, you know, after a couple days of listening to the story, listening to the radio station, it's like, would somebody please turn off this radio station? Would somebody please change the channel? And then it doesn't happen. Really, whose job is it to change the channel? Would you please change the channel? And then maybe by the third day, I go, I know who controls the radio channel. It's me. Maybe I'll try turning down the channel. Maybe I'll try turning it off, or at least listen to a different channel. Maybe instead of listening to the Ain't It Awful Poor Me channel, I could listen to the Appreciation channel. That would make Jean very happy, I'm sure. Just listen to that Appreciation channel. Another way to think about ending it, I think, is to look deeply to see the true nature of things. Cut through the obstructions that keep us from witnessing and experiencing direct perception. And I think that's different for all of us. That's why you have to study your own delusion. You know, we can read these stories, we can read books, we can talk to other people about what they do, but you live with your mind. I live with my mind, so the best medicine is to study your own mind, to study the self so that you can forget the self. And forget the self so you can be actualized by the myriad things, which is kind of that beginning construct about, you know, to carry oneself forward and try to put yourself on the world is delusion, but to that the world, that the myriad things come forth and experience themselves is awakening. So on a personal level, what do I need to do to just make space to allow the world to come forth, to allow myself to actually see the world instead of my internal shadow play? So I said I was going to talk about four, and I've talked about three so far. What are they? What are some responses to delusion? We can study it. We can arouse our practice in the midst of it. We can end it. And at the same time, we have to watch out that we don't suffer the delusion of trying to get rid of delusion. This is where you start going, oh, Zen, oh, my God, you know. Here we just got all convinced that we really need to end our delusion. And I'm saying, ultimately, you can't really get rid of it because it's you. And this is another really great analogy from that Lotus Sutra class of Reb. I think I have the quote. I want to read it. He talked about your delusion. It's like your family. oh, I don't want to be around my family. Well, some of us want to, some of us don't. But, you know, oh, my family, it's like, get me out of here. I want to leave home. I want to get away from those people. And yet, don't they live within us? Don't they live within us? So there's some way, and I'm not talking about, you know, if you have an abusive family, obviously you're going to leave your abusive family. If you're involved in a toxic situation, of course you're going to protect yourself and get out of it. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about this way that we just don't want to be who we are, and that we want to judge ourselves and judge others so much. So let me find, where is that wonderful quote? Here it is. From the Lotus Sutra class, Reb said, our tendency, pardon me, I'm going to swear, it's a quote, our tendency is to want to leave the shit, leave the deluded self. Deluded self wants to leave deluded self. I encourage deluded self to come back and be fully with deluded self. No matter how long you've been away from yourself, you will someday come home. My dharma is the truth of how my deluded mind works. I'm going to read that again. My dharma is the truth of how my deluded mind works. I can't open to Buddha mind without opening to deluded mind. You know, it's hard to really own that, but it's ultimately so liberating, because then we're working with our true being rather than some fantasy of who we think we're supposed to be. So Lori and I were talking a bit about this, and she sent a poem that I think says pretty much the same thing that Reb's quote just said. And I want to read it, and then I think I want to open it up for questions or discussion before I make any other points. So this is a poem called Love After Love, and it's by Derek Walcott. The time will come when, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit. Feast on your life. So I think this is what he's inviting us to do in this poem. Ultimately, our dharma is understanding and confessing and working with and loving our deluded self. And I would say also the deluded selves of others. Because we're all in the boat together. We're all in the delusion boat together. And both sides are practice. Whether we are, this thing also in that class was this idea of turning the Dharma wheel or being turned by the Dharma wheel. It's like if we're in our delusion, we are being turned by the Dharma wheel. You know, oh God, I don't like what's happening. I don't know what's happening. I'm being turned by the causes and conditions and circumstances in life. And when we're awake to our delusion, and when we're coming from an awareness of that, then we're turning the Dharma wheel. We've got a little bit of participation. We're engaged with it rather than being run over by it. So it's about engagement with our delusion in service of awakening together. There certainly are some other things that I could say, but at this point I think it would be good to hear your voices, whether it be a question or some reflection that you're having as you're thinking about this subject with relationship to your own path, how you practice with this maybe more difficult side of our humanness. Yeah.
In addition to confession and repentance, what are some other practices? There's suffering.
What do you do?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think what you just said is really helpful, is to notice, am I escalating or am I de-escalating, just almost at a physical level? And if I'm escalating and I don't want to be escalating, is there something I can do to calm myself a little bit? And then look within, take the inward step and look at our mind. One of the things I do sometimes, and this is, it's very hard. I'm not saying this is an easy practice. This is hard, and it's kind of terrifying, but I think it's powerfully liberating, is I start, if I'm really, really, really worked up about something and I think it's out there, I start looking at, what is this touching in me? What is it in me that is being touched by this difficulty? And go inside. And obviously I can't do this in the moment. I'm not that skilled. So maybe take a time out, or after, you know, I get myself out of the situation, sit quietly and study. What is this? Touch it. Try to touch it. Try to touch the root of it. What is it? Because usually for me there's some kind of pain. There's some kind of fear. There's some kind of, I don't know, something about me that is scaring me. So then I just work with that. Yeah.
One of the practices I work with,
yeah,
is trying to see the suffering that my own religion has caused. And I might not be so willing at first, at least, to drop my delusion for my own sake.
Right.
But I'm always happy to drop it.
A little trick, a bodhisattva trick. Yeah.
And it helps me own.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's I think that's also a really good thing to do, is to be aware of the impact that I'm having on others. Yeah.
One of my practices to notice my delusion, or the great delusion of there's this self and there's this other, is to have more of an affinity with people. Something happened today. I was turning my car around at the dojo over there, and it's a very tight parking lot. And I was turning around because I was going to back up into my spot so I could read my books. And this guy wanted to sneak around me, and I had to keep stopping. And he's like, "Oh, okay, she's backing up." And then I'm turning some more, and then he tries to sneak again. And I started feeling that escalating that Patrick was talking about. And I was like, "Can you believe?" I was just like, "Do you think you can wait?" After it was all over, I started laughing because I'm like, "I've done that before.
Yeah.
He's
yeah.
no different."
Yeah. Yeah.
From what I had done before, sneaking around trucks, figuring my way, and stuff like that. Yeah. So just having this affinity, all the same.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I do that. I've done that before. Oh. Yeah. Yeah, Johnny.
I contemplate freedom three ways. And when I'm really caught into the story, I think of freedom from the story.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next thing I think of is freedom to do something in the space that's left when I get bored. And finally, there's freedom with.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's ultimately the sitting practice we do, is to get to sitting with.
Sitting with, yeah, just sitting with.
Sitting with ourselves.
Sitting with ourselves. Yep. Yeah. Yes, not yet.
And I do find that very helpful. I then often proceed to make a slightly more integrated type of less dualistic hypothesis.
Yeah.
And sometimes occasionally go, "Oh, maybe that's what happened."
Yeah.
And then my mind is calm.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, "Oh, that probably that's the less deluded thought."
Mm-hmm. These are wonderful, wonderful suggestions. Yeah, Nanette. A problem. Oh, bring it on. Bring it on. You're in good company.
It's the one that comes around so much that I have a lot of feeling attached.
Yeah.
But I want to know, when I know how confused I am, because I can feel it in my body and my mind is wild, I don't know how to act, and I don't know where to find any trust in what's going to come out of my mouth, or what I'm going to do, or I don't know where to go from there. It's like I can clearly see my of confusion. I can feel it in my body. And I have to act. And I have to speak. So how do I do that? Where do I go to find some faith that what's going to come out of my mouth isn't going to cause harm?
Have you had any success at all, in even a small way, in dealing with this problem? Or is it always, 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 like, do you always blow it?
I'm laughing and skipping.
Do you always blow it?
I must have had some success because I have a pretty delightful life.
Oh. So sometimes you know how to find that place.
I haven't done too much damage, but it's like the feeling that I'm like completely immobilized. Like, I don't know where to turn. So, I want somebody else to I don't know. You know, I guess it just is.
Hey, Edie. Yeah.
I think it's when you identify that space. There's a space between what you're describing. The space between I could react and here's where I'm at right now. But you've already described there's a space in there, right? That gives you a little place to make a decision about what's next. I mean, I'm hearing there's a space in there.
It's true, and I don't see myself as someone who tends to be reactive. But on the other hand, where I feel like I kind of get frozen.
So Nanette, can you love the aspect that you have of the one who doesn't know what to do and who feels like she should be different and who struggles with fear that she's not going to say the right thing? Can you invite her to the table too? Oh, there you are again. Hello. Come in, sit down. I know you so well.
You too
are welcome.
Maybe renaming it from frozen to just naming it space.
Give it a different name.
Yeah,
there's that space. But I mean, I think this is really, you know, we talk about this. It's not the first time we've talked about this here, you know, is this edge of, well, yeah, we want to improve ourselves and we want to be better and we want to be happier and we want to be liberated and we want to be free from suffering and we want others to have that as well. And of course, that's why we're here, even though they say, oh, there's no goal, but excuse me. We wouldn't do this if we weren't hoping that something was going to happen that's good, you know? However, there is this way that it's also this and not thinking that there's something wrong with you and that you have to cut out this part of yourself that does these things that you wish you didn't do. It's like there's something about that. You know, the poem. Where's that poem? How did he put it? Oh, this is such a beautiful poem. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. You know, there's something about that I think that's just helpful to do, to invite in and include that one in ourselves and in others when we can. I mean, you know, sometimes we can't. But when we can, to do that. So when do we usually stop? Is it 25, 7:25 kind of when we do? I mean, that's what I used to remember. It's been a while since I've been here, and I've never given a talk from this seat. I think everybody who does it has that first feeling of like, nope. But it's a fine seat. It's very well warmed up by our dear recently deceased abbot. So I think I'm going to just say then, let's just keep on doing this practice together and supporting each other, confessing and repenting and celebrating and feasting on our lives, in our lives together. Beings are numberless, I bow to save them. Illusions are inexhaustible.